track session number 20308, Reel 3.
So, Garrett, Reel 3.
I was lucky in as much as, although I was very ill, I was on the hospital ship, because many of the other members of my regiment who were also in the hospital were battened down below hatches on a barge going back to Italy after it had delivered supplies to the Italian and German troops in Tobruk, and it was sunk by one of our own submarines, because there was no way that they'd got markings on the boat. They were battened down below hatches, and we only knew about it because the only survivor was the only one allowed. They would only allow one man on deck at a time to go to the toilet, and the only survivor was one of our regiment, who was actually on the toilet when the thing was torpedoed. The submarine picked him up, and that's how we know that the rest of the regiment, or not the rest, a lot of our regiment, died of drowning in that barge. And I can tell you now that Danny Whale, that's the name of the one that was rescued, punched the submarine commander under the chin and nearly knocked him out for killing all his friends. However, I was lucky. I went back on the hospital ship to Naples, and I was taken to a prison camp hospital in Caserta, which is just inland from Naples. There I spent, five or six months gradually getting better on Red Cross food. The Italian Red Cross nurse, who was a countess, but now I have found out since that 90% of the population of Italy, if they've got enough money, are countesses. She was very good to us. She did what she could for us. But the religious sisters, the nurses, were bitches. In our particular case, they were. I'm going to ask you a question now. Are you a Catholic? No. Or are you more likely to believe what I tell you? Sœur Agostina, that was her name. Sœur, I don't know why they don't call her Sorella, it's Sœur, S-O-U-R-A. More important than a Sorella, perhaps. Anyway, one to a reparto. That means one to a little a building which had got a lower and upper floors of wards in them. Now, our daily ration from the Italians was a bowl of soup, only once a day. And it would be wheeled round in a great big channel, turn, and ladle, one ladle at a time for every prisoner, all right? Now, there was never, it tasted of meat, it looked brown, it had the odd bit of vegetable, if you were lucky, bit of cabbage stalk or a potato, or you might get in your supply, but never any meat. Now, by now, I spoke quite a bit of Italian, I'd picked up, and I got friendly with the Italian orderlies, who were, they were only peasants and quite pleasant people, really. And I said to them one day, said to one of them, there's never any meat in it. Ah, he said, now you know why the Sorella, I'll call her Sorella from now on, it's easier to say, has it wheeled into her reparto, her office, first. I said, well, why? He said, come with me. And there, the Sorella's office was at the end of the balcony there. There, the soldiers' rest room was there. And he took a picture, a religious picture, off the wall, and it was only wooden panelling, and there was a gap you could see through. He said, watch. Because she'd just taken it in, and there she was with the ladle, taking out all the meat, putting it on a tray. So then she took it and wheeled it round the wards. I said, oh, now I know why we never get any meat, but I can understand that if she's hungry. Oh, he said, no, it's not for her, it's for us. I said, well, I can understand that if you're hungry. Oh, he said, she makes us pay for it. He said, then at the end of the month, when she's got a lot of money, she goes to the Mother Superior and says, look what I've got for the church. Now, that put me, I was already becoming agnostic. That really turned the corner. I remember back in Beni Yusuf, no, back in Almazar after Greece, I went to my major and I said, I don't want to attend a church parade anymore, sir. He said, why not, Garrett? I said, well, I've never done anybody any harm on purpose. and I object to being told every time I go into the church that I'm a sinner. I'm not a sinner. I've never hurt anybody. He said, I think I understand you. He said, you'll have to parade, march there. You'll have to be afterwards on parade to march back. He said, in the meantime, for the hour that we're in there, you can do what you want. So I used to go and get cups of tea in the nappy or something to eat or have my hair cut or whatever I needed to do. But I refused to be told I was a sinner when I felt I hadn't done anybody any harm on purpose ever. And so I was lucky. Major Fuchs was a good man, he understood me. Now, where am I as far as the war is concerned?
Well, you're in Caserta Hospital.
Caserta Hospital. Well, I spent a fair time there. The Italian doctor came round and he looked at us, but he didn't really do anything for us. All he would do was take any mustard or pepper out of our Red Cross parcels. He wouldn't let us have it. Now, maybe because we'd all got dysentery in this part of the hospital, he was doing the right thing. Anyway, I'll come to that later on, what he did with the mustard and the pepper. We noticed the next reparto to us, about 20 yards away, they were wounded. There were bandages everywhere. And on Sundays, when the hospital was thrown open for the Italian civilians to come and visit the soldiers, they used to give the chaps in the next reparto with the bandages cakes and biscuits and all sorts of things. They never gave us any, because all we got was dysentery. We couldn't show we got dysentery. So we got some bandages, and we used to sit out there and get cakes and biscuits as well. Anyway, eventually they started beginning to close the hospital, our part of the hospital, down. And in batches, they were being sent to a prison camp, an ordinary prison camp. Now, they took half of what we'd got in our reparto and shipped them off, but I was in the half that was left behind, but they wanted to close our bit down, so they moved us into another reparto, where they'd all had diphtheria, if you please. But we fortunately didn't catch it. Anyway, it so happens that the office at the end of this was where our particular doctor, Italian doctor, who visited us every day, had his office. And he called me in. He knew I was an artist. And he wanted me to paint some, do some labels, sister's doctor, to put on the doors. So I said, yes, all right, but I can't sit on the bed and go, I've got to have a table. He said, it's all right, I'm out nearly all day long, use my table in my office. Well, being an inquisitive prisoner of war, English, I opened his cupboards, and they were full of tins of mustard and pepper. So I got hold of one of the mine orderlies. I said, what do you want all this for? He said, he sells it. I said, right. Outside, there'd been up some builders. I told all the blokes in my reparto what was happening. We very carefully opened the tins, tipped most of the mustard out, filled it with sand, and put a little bit of mustard or pepper or what should have been there on top. We couldn't do a whole cupboard full, but we did quite a few hundred tins in a couple of weeks we were there. So then, I don't know that he ever tried to sell those, but I bet it didn't get on very well. This is our way of getting back. I remember going back now to... That comes later on. When our medical staff, the sergeant and the two orderlies, the two corporals, medical orderlies, left before us, the officer, the doctor said, Garrity said, would you take over the office they were in and see what's in there and distribute anything you think that should be distributed? And then, of course, I realised how the medical staff were cheating the rest of us. There were toothbrushes and toothpaste, packets of chocolate, biscuits and the Red Cross. And I distributed them round to everybody, even the Indians. And they'd never had anyone treat them on an equal to our British soldiers. And I went round with the toothpaste, I gave them all a toothbrush, I went round with the toothpaste, and wasn't very much of it, and squeezed a bit on their things, and any left over, if I could do so, I left with the senior sergeant, Indian sergeant, to distribute as he saw fit. Now, when we left there, I was very, very weak, and I was carrying more equipment than I should have done, because I'd still got my portfolio. And when he saw me staggering with this lot, I don't know what he said, don't know what language he used, Hindi or whatever, two of them came over and carried all my equipment into the prison camp for me that we'd gone to. Because I'd been good to them then, they were trying to be good to me in return. One thing I've just remembered, on the train going from the prison camp hospital in Caserta to the prison camp in Capua, we're all sitting facing each other with a guard with their rifle. Oh, it got so hot in this bloody thing. And I said to the orderly, I opened the window and I said, no. I said, yeah. Si, momento. He gave me his rifle to hold and opened the window for me. Yeah, you see what I mean about comic opera soldiers? Anyway.
So you went to Capua?
Capua, yes. Wasn't very long there. It was a shambles, because the 50 men to a tent, nobody seemed to want to take any responsibility. We'd got sergeants, bombardiers, corporals, the lot in there. But I realised that I had a reasonable organising ability, because it had been used with my regiment, not giving me stripes, but giving me responsibilities. So I volunteered to be hut commander and do all the dirty work as necessary. They were only too pleased to let me. As a gunner, I was telling sergeants what to do. But it worked, because they all got a fair ration. Nobody, I didn't cheat anybody. I made them queue up in alphabetical order the very first day I was in charge, when the tea came, a great big container of tea, and ladled out of mugful to every man in alphabetical order. If there was any left over when they'd all been, then I want the man who was first to come again, always in the same order. If it finished at Johnson, and then the next day it was finished at the next chap whose name began with J. So that they always came round in the same order for their bread and for their tea. That way they all got a fair do. Well, in no time at all, the Sergeant Major who was in charge of our camp, Sergeant Major Burgess, he was Sergeant Major over the Sudanese, once more a very nice chap. And he found out that I was an artist. He said, could you run a newspaper? So I said, I could, but I haven't got anything to run. Oh, he said, you'd have to write it by hand. You'd have to do one copy for every hut. So I said, Christ, I said, I shan't have time to eat and do anything. I am hut commander. He said, all right, if you can find two or three people to help you, I'll see you all get an extra loaf for doing it. And a loaf was the size of a roll. And it was the one thing we were short of, because we were getting Red Cross supplies, but with many of those things, you need bread with it. Anyway, that went on for a long time. I organised all the sport. I used to play in the cricket matches. Mind you, our playing area was the size of roughly a football penalty area. No bigger than that for football or cricket. They're playing cricket. If the ball went through the wire, you had to get the sentry to throw it back. Now, soon after we got there, the Americans were being taken prisoner up in North Africa. They began to arrive, and the Germans, much more efficient than the Italians, had got prefabricated huts. They gave the Americans all the equipment. The barbed wire was around them anyway. So, right, there you are, build your own huts, which they did. Now, when the German sentries saw the Italians demanding a cigarette before they threw our ball back, they used to fire at the Italian sentries' feet with their rifles till they gave the ball back for nothing. There again, I was in the concert party. One day the concert party started. It was organised by one of these chaps who used to go around the working men's clubs in the Midlands. And he was quite a good comedian, quite a good singer, actually. And he got one or two other people with him. One week he had a conjurer. Now, I'd always done a bit of conjuring as a child. And this chap came on the stage with a small cardboard box, And he said, look, and he tipped it up, and there were cabbage stalks in it. He said, I'm going to make them disappear. Shove it down. So he ate them. And he was booed off the stage. A request came round, does anybody know any conjuring? And I said, I knew a bit. So they said, right, you're in. I didn't want to be in the concert party as well. I was fully occupied, I can assure you. That was the best way to be, in my opinion. Not just sit round on your bed all day long. So I was hut commander. I had to dish out all the rations for them. I was writing the newspapers. I was doing all the drawings in the newspapers, which were done on toilet paper, about 5 pages, 6 pages a week for every hut, 15 huts. I was organising and playing in all the cricket or football. I was refereeing the games I wasn't playing in. And I was fully occupied. Anyway, I was in the concert party, and my very first trick, apparently this is, was just a matter of luck. If you take a sheet of paper, I haven't got a sheet of paper.
Describe it.
Well, if you turn it into a cone, wrap it round to like a large ice cream cone, show it empty, show it with nothing in there, nothing up your sleeves, make this cone, put your hand in. Now, in this country, I would pull out silk handkerchiefs. I didn't have those, so I pulled out a long piece of paper on which I'd written, no connection with last week's conjurer. I turned it over and it said, pas de connexion de la prestidigiteur de la semaine passée. It brought the house down. It didn't matter if I made a mistake from that moment on. that was all right, fine. But the rhyme leading up to, they formed a theatrical group. They wanted me to join. I don't know, I just do not have time. And I said, I'm not an actor. But I did volunteer to do the, what do they call it, the chap stands at the side of the stage with the prompt. And I was there with the prompt. Well, then they got a play going, or were going to get a play going, about six or seven men in the Arctic, and one of them gets up and stumbles out, and then is never seen again. And they said, well, look, we've got to have one more man for this. If you do that, you're off the stage in a couple of minutes, and you can go and do the prompting. So I said, all right, I would. Well, I'm laying on my bed when the curtain goes up, with the others sitting around, and I get up and I stumble over a stool. The only words I have to say are, oh my God, I'm going blind. And a voice from the back of the hut said, you're telling us, ref. Brought the house down again, we had to start again. Well, there, you've got to make do and make the best of things. Now, what we used to do, we weren't, by all the rules and regulations of the Army and the Red Cross, supposed to swap anything from the Red Cross over the wire with the sentries. And we didn't, but it looked as if we were. Because we would get bread for it, and that was the one thing we were short of. If you took a tin of, you know what a tin of cocoa looks like? If you ease the paper around the top, you can take the lid off without tearing the, you tip the cocoa out, a bit like the mustard and the pepper. You leave some cocoa in the bottom of that little paper packet inside. You fill it up with dirt, and you put some cocoa on top. Then you put the lid back, and they got used to being caught out. That's why we put the cocoa top and bottom. And if you said how many loaves, and you got an agreement of 8 loaves for this tin, and you pass him the tin, he'd wet his finger, open the paper, put his finger and get cocoa, all fine, you get your bread. That's fair enough. But I think the best thing was done by, oh, we had some French Foreign Legion troops, prisoners of war, even Germans and Italians. We had an Italian opera singer and a German who'd been in the chorus at something or other. And they all used to join in because they were prisoners like we were. Anyway, this Foreign Legion Frenchman had a brilliant idea. Occasionally he used to get, not a Red Cross parcel, but Red Cross parcels from Red Cross crates from Canada. In other words, instead of having a parcel with everything in, a cardboard parcel with everything in, you would get a crate, a small crate, one full of butter, one full of cocoa, one full of M&B, and they'd dish out a tin to everybody, you see, that way. Well, there used to be a tin of butter about that round and about that. It was gorgeous stuff. But before you got it, you would have to go up to the desk the table where they were issuing it from, and the Italian would have a thing with a spike on the end, two holes. You couldn't store it for more than a week, or else it would go bad, and you couldn't therefore take it and escape with it. Well, he immersed, this chap immersed this tin in a can of boiling water. Not immersed it, floated it, just so that the water was below the level of the top, which melted all the butter in the inside. He then took it, while it was still in this condition, and shook it all out through the holes into another tin, where you could have the butter yourself when it solidified. Now, all the butter never came out naturally, because there would be grease still around the inside of the tin. By now, the boiling water would have got just warm water. You very carefully fill up the tin through those two holes with warm water. When that water got cold, all the grease had risen to the top and showed through the two holes that had been poked in it, and it looked like a normal tin of butter. He got 15 loaves for that. And, well, we were up to all sorts of tricks. One amazing thing, the Italian sergeant major, who more or less ran the camp, we very rarely saw an Italian officer except in the mornings when they were counting us. He had a strong, he spoke English with a strong Scottish accent. And what, he was Italian, but he lived in Edinburgh. He'd been there for years. He got a greengrocer's business there. He'd been in Italy to visit his mother and the family when war was declared, and they'd immediately said, right, you speak English, you can be the interpreter. They gave him rank of sergeant major and put him in charge of us. He used to do more for us than he did for his own lot. I never did remember his name, but that was good. What else about that camp? Oh, yes, well, we had a silly half hour once. We decided we were going to put the wind up the Italians. We opened the windows in the hut, and people leaned out with a handkerchief, and they banged the sign. We're going now, cheerio, bye-bye, arrivederci. And they ran round, firing their rifles in the air. At least it occupied them. Going back to the hospital in Caserta, that was another trick. We had electric light bulbs high up in the ceiling. It was a high ceiling. They had to be on all night. And you had doors at the end of the place onto a balcony, you see. So that if you opened the door at night, the light would shine. They'd know you were opening your doors. They would shout at you to go back inside. And there were sentries at each corner, and at the middle, there were six sentries, each with his own little hut, all round at night. And typical Italians, this one would call out, I'm a dog, woof, woof, woof. I'm a cat, meow, meow, meow. I'm a horse. I'm a something else. All the way around. All night long you get these soppy little calls to bolster up their morale in case we attack them. So what we used to do, we used to put three beds each on top of the other. Someone would climb up and take out the electric light bulb, but so that your ward was in darkness. You could open the doors and no lights would show. We'd take the electric light bulb and throw it in the air. Of course, it bang when it hit the ground. They used to run thinking we'd all escaped. Anything to occupy them, anything to annoy them. These are the tricks we got up to. However, where am I? Oh, dear.
What happened when Italy collapsed?
Well, I'd escaped a few days before that. Well, let me explain. We were being sent in batches. When our troops invaded Sicily, the Germans insisted we'd be sent to Germany. Prior to the Italians capitulating, they sent us in batches to Germany. On my way up, there'd been a derailment of a train on our line. So they'd stopped us near a prison camp in Macerata, which is on the bulge on the Adriatic side, bulge of the leg, if you imagine Italy as a leg. And they were already overcrowded, and there was a full-size football pitch, but it was only gravel. And I was on the edge of the football pitch in my tent. Well, naturally, I watched the football for a couple of days, and I met a few of the regiment that had been there some time. Don't start getting other things out of you. There was a door. Oh, the sentry, there was a great high wall, 1.5 times as high as this room. And it must have been a wide wall because the sentries could walk round on it. So there were sentry posts on every various places. Right behind the goal was a sentry box up above it. The goal was about, 5-6 yards from the goal line. The wall and the door in it, the one door in it. I don't think I ever saw another door. I wasn't long enough to find out, anyway. It was right behind the goal. Now, I thought, I was leaning on this door one day, watching the pot, it's moving. Yeah, it's moving. And I went over a great big metal handle, rusted in. I doubt if it had ever been opened. Been there years without being opened, I'm sure. And no way could you get out that side. But I realised, every time I rubbed this, the bolts in the wall were getting looser and looser. So when I realised this, I thought, well, I'm going to keep on. I kept on, got the bolts out, and by bloody well pushing hard and trying to lift, I shifted the door a bit. So I went back to my tent. I told the rest of them, well, I was going to try and get out, and six of them came with me. We went round behind the goal, and of course the sentry's watching the football all the time, and he can't see us down below him. And between us, we got this door open enough for us to squeeze out. And we all, seven of us, went out together. Late evening, we got into the vineyards, and we were amazed. There's all these bunches of grapes. We'd never seen anything like this since we left England. But we felt guilty when we were picking the odd bunch and eating it. Of course, the Italians live on grapes at that time of the year. They, with a slice of bread and a bunch of grapes, that's their meal. That's what we got. We hadn't realised. We were thinking, nobody's looking, you know, bunch of grapes. However, we got away, six of us, or seven of us. And we were going over ploughed fields at night when you're not fit is not the best thing to do. Because it was so difficult walking over those ploughed fields because you couldn't see where you were putting your foot. You were stumbling at night time. But the idea was to get as far away from the prison camp as possible before daylight. Well, this went on for some days. Some villagers gave us sustenance, drink, mostly wine, because a few of them had got water, and something to eat. But you had to be very careful. Now, they more or less let me take charge of them, the six, because by now I was the only one of the group who spoke any Italian. And you had to be very careful because in some houses you'd be invited in for a meal and they'd give you some food to carry away with you. The son and the daughter would stand outside in case anybody was coming to warn you. At other houses, and you must realise that all fascists didn't have uniforms, they might send the son and the daughter to the village to get the fascisti or the police. So what I did was made sure one of our chaps was always outside, letting him warn us. We'd take him food out there. And I think that was a sensible thing to do. Now,
did you stay in one place or travel about?
Oh, I travelled about for the first 2 or 3 weeks. Okay. But then again, you see, I found we were meeting prisoners who'd escaped from other prison camps. By now, Italy had capitulated. After we escaped, they capitulated and shipped all those in our camp to Germany, as they did in all the other camps. But a lot of them had got away during that period. And we were meeting them. We were heading towards their prison camp. They were heading towards ours. And I said, whoa, wait a minute, let's think about this. We can't do this. We'll have to hold up and stay somewhere. Well, we found a small cave in a wooded area on the other side of a small valley where there was a village. Can't remember the name of it for the moment. Doesn't matter, something Castello. We stayed there for a while. Now, two of them wanted to carry on and go down south. Now, I said, I don't think that's sensible. It's up to you. I'm not going to dictate to you. The reason I said this is because although you could possibly get through the front lines where the